Please stand by. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Epstein, Becker, and Green audio conference, The Government Interest in Academic Medical Centers and Teaching Institutions' Financial Relationship with Physicians. Today's conference is being recorded. Everyone is in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, instructions for the question-and-answer session will be given at that time. And at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Ms. Jana Clark-Anderson. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Good afternoon. I'm Jana Clark-Anderson, and I'm an attorney with Epstein, Becker, and Green. I focus my practice on advising clients regarding compliance with fraud and abuse and Medicare and Medicaid coverage, reimbursement, and enrollment rules. I'm joined in this teleconference by four colleagues who are all members of our firm, David Matthias, Carrie Valiant, Marcy Handler, and Beth Essig. All have decades of experience representing academic medical centers. Carrie is co-chair of the firm's fraud and abuse practice group. Carrie and David are co-authors of an American Health Lawyer Association book entitled Legal Issues and Healthcare Fraud and Abuse, which is in its third edition. Marcy previously served as vice chair of the AHLA practice group on teaching hospitals and academic medical centers for several years and was named among the outstanding hospital lawyers in 2005 by Nightingale's Healthcare News. Beth, prior to joining EBG, was deputy general counsel of a major academic medical center. We'd like to thank you all for joining us today. We're really happy that this teleconference generated so much interest. We have over 300 subscribers today, so welcome. So quickly switching to the agenda on slide two, because we have a lot to cover in very little time, we're going to discuss various AMC models, then we're going to give an overview of the Federal Physician Self-Referral Law, commonly known as the Stark Law, and the AMC exception to that law. We're also going to quickly review other potentially relevant Stark exceptions in the Federal Anti-Kickback Statute and its safe harbors. Carrie's then going to talk about recent government enforcement actions under the Stark Law and the Anti-Kickback Statute related to AMCs. Beth will talk about CMS and IRS documents that have been designed to enhance disclosure and transparency of physician relationships. And then we're going to open it up for questions from you guys. We'll not have time, just so you know, during this teleconference to discuss healthcare physician or healthcare professional vendor relationships, like relationships with pharmaceutical or device manufacturers, which, as you know, is the subject of a lot of policy making by AMCs. But there has been a lot of movement in that area, so please reach out to one of us if you have questions with regard to that. Just so you know as well, there's going to be a CLE number that's provided at the end of the presentation, and now I'm going to turn it over to Beth Essig to discuss AMC models.
Thank you. Before I begin, I want to remind you that the slides that we're going to be referring to were distributed to all participants by email, and they're also available on the ebglaw.com website, and it will make following along this presentation much easier. I want to talk a little bit about the models of academic medical centers. We all know that academic medical centers are critical to the delivery of patient care in this country. They're critical for research, education, and there are many, many models. If you look at slide three in the materials, you'll see a very simple, straightforward model where the academic medical center is in a single entity and it employs many physicians. And if that was the way that academic medical centers related to their physicians, this would be a very easy teleconference. If you look at slide four and five, we start to layer on in almost crystalline complexity as we look at the various ways academic medical centers are structured. And the way academic medical centers are structured, as we all know, is governed by things like the particular academic medical center's unique culture. If you've seen one academic medical center, you've seen one academic medical center. These medical centers have evolved over time, and relationships have evolved, and the legal structures are the result of that evolution. And state law is very important, so we see various models. Now, all academic medical centers have schools of medicine or similar entities, faculty practices, and hospitals. So slide four shows a model where there's a hospital, and the hospital relates to a combined school of medicine and faculty practice, where the physicians refer patients to the hospital but are employed by the School of Medicine faculty practice. And slide five shows an even more complex model where there's a School of Medicine, a faculty practice, and a hospital. They're all separate, and they have multiple relationships with each other. And you can imagine this going out into infinity, multiple hospitals, two schools of medicine, one hospital, four hospitals, different faculty practices structured as foundations, faculty practices that are captive PCs, faculty practices in some states are permitted as not-for-profit corporations. So we have a very complex and critical kind of entity that really needed to be addressed by the government when it thought about how these hospital-physician relationships were governed. And with that, I'm going to turn this back. This was background, and I'll turn this back to Jana, who will provide an overview of the Stark Law.
Hi, everyone. So on slide 7, it gives a brief overview of the Stark Law. And the Stark Law prohibits a physician from referring designated health services that are payable by Medicare to an entity with which the physician or a physician's immediate family member has a financial relationship, unless the relationship meets an exception. So when you're talking about financial relationship, it can be either a compensation or an ownership arrangement. And keep in mind that the arrangement does not need to be related to the designated health services in order to implicate the Stark Law. Further, the Stark Law prohibits the entity from filing any claims for the designated health services that were the result of a prohibited referral. So the upshot of a Stark violation, as you'll see on A, slide 8, the Stark Law is a strict liability statute, so as such, your intent is irrelevant. It doesn't matter if it was an accidental or if it was a technical violation. If your arrangement violates Stark, the arrangement must meet an ownership or compensation exception because the penalties under Stark are broad. They include a $15,000 civil money penalty, or CMP, per service, and 2 times the reimbursement claim, the CMP of $100,000, can be imposed for circumvention schemes like cross-referral arrangements. Medicare and Medicaid exclusion is a possibility, and there's a potential for bootstrap claims under the Federal False Claims Act, which can result in treble damages. So looking at slide 9, it shows a little bit of the history of the Stark Law. As you can see, the rules have spanned over 13 years, with 3 of the 6 final rules occurring since September 2007. Phase 1, 2, 3, and the 2009 IPPS final rule address the AMC exception and the AMC relationships with physicians. And as we'll discuss, the AMC exception will protect many of the arrangements between AMC components, but it's not going to protect all physician financial relationships. So you're going to need to be familiar with the other Stark Law exceptions. The Stark Law regulatory exceptions, just so you know, and I'm sure most of you do know, can be used for ownership or compensation arrangements that involve physicians, and some of the exceptions can be used for both ownership and compensation arrangements. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Marcy to discuss the AMC exception.
Interestingly, the Stark statute itself does not have an exception for academic medical centers. The statute only includes a reference to faculty practice plans in connection with the special provisions discussing profitability and productivity bonuses available to group practices, which is helpful in its suggestion that faculty practice plans can qualify as groups, but the statute, of course, predates the existence of the academic medical center exception, which is wholly a creature of regulation. The fact that the AMC exception is regulatory in some ways has been very helpful because it's given the industry the opportunity to work with and convince CMS that academic institutions deserve special protection. But it's also been subject to the same regulatory changes that have affected Stark over time, as Jana described, in that the regulations change every so often and the government's view of certain key issues changes or even flip-flops over time, and those issues affect academic medical centers in the same way as they do other entities that are covered by Stark. And in particular, I'm thinking of some of the issues you may be familiar with, such as physicians stand in the shoes, the use of percentages, et cetera. And we'll talk about some of those issues and how they relate to the academic medical center exception in more detail over the course of the presentation. I'm now on slide 11. In light of the lack of a broader academic medical center exception in the statute, the industry had for many years urged CMS to create a separate exception. They argued that the group practice rules really didn't work to protect their financial relationships because the group practice rules in and of themselves didn't protect the money that flows from and between the entities in an academic system outside of the faculty practice plan, which could create indirect financial relationships with physicians, but which weren't necessarily tied to a fair market value paid in exchange for services concept, and were instead paid to support the strategic and operational endeavors consistent with the academic medical center's academic and clinical teaching missions. So finally, in the Phase 1 final rule, CMS adopted the original iteration of the academic medical center exception, citing to the unique circumstances and the symbiotic relationship among faculty and medical centers and teaching institutions. And in adopting the academic medical center exception, it focused on three key areas, which we'll talk about in the next few slides. The first key area of the exception is who are the components or the entities within an academic medical center that should be protected. The second area is what are the funds that are being transferred among the components being used for and what purposes should be protected. And the third area is how are the doctors within the academic medical center getting paid? Which of the doctors are integral to the academic medical center's academic mission and how should they be protected within the exception? What ends up being protected if you meet the academic medical center exception are the services that are furnished by the academic medical center components and billed to Medicare. So it's not simply protection for the specific payment relationship with a particular referring physician that's protected. What you have is a concept of the aggregate or the totality of the financial relationships with faculty being protected within the academic medical center exception. Moving to slide 12, to take advantage of the academic medical center exception, you have to have an AMC as defined by Stark, and that includes the following minimum components. Number one, an accredited medical school, which could include a university, or an accredited academic hospital, which is a hospital that has four or more approved medical education programs. Number two, you have to have an affiliated practice, faculty practice plan. And number three, you need to have at least one affiliated hospital, which is defined as a hospital where a majority of the medical staff physicians are faculty and a majority of the admissions come from faculty. And the accredited academic hospital, the one with the four or more medical education programs, could also be the affiliated hospital if that hospital also meets this majority test. So to have a qualified AMC under Stark, you always have to have at least a faculty practice plan and at least one hospital. But you could have more than that and still qualify under Stark. Now, on the other hand, the exception doesn't dictate a minimum number of corporate entities within the academic medical system. It only dictates, in essence, these functions, the medical school, the plan, the affiliated hospitals. So you could have one or more of these components within the same corporate entity and still qualify, or they could be separate. And we think back to the models that Beth described at the beginning of the presentation. On slide 13, we've included an excerpt from the preamble from the Phase 1 final rules when the AMC exception was first issued. And I put it in here to highlight, you know, the point that although there's a minimum set of entities that are necessary to qualify for the academic medical center protection, the protection extends to as many entities within the academic system as can meet the requirements. So you could have multiple faculty practice plans, multiple hospitals, et cetera. And interestingly, this is the only Stark exception in this way that really offers this multiple party protection. Most of the other exceptions that folks need to work with are much more bilateral. You know, a hospital and a doctor's specific financial relationship is protected. And so that makes the AMC exception different in terms of its compliance implications. Moving to page 14, one of the absolutely fundamental requirements for academic medical center exception under Stark is centers on the purposes for which transfers of money between the components are used, what they're directed for. And there's only four authorized or protected purposes. They're specifically listed in the reg and reflected in this slide. They are teaching, indigent care, research, and community service. And so that creates two real operational implications for folks trying to qualify for the academic medical center exception. The first implication is, obviously, if money is being intended or applied for any other purpose other than one of the four, then you're potentially not protected by the academic medical center exception. So if that funds flow creates a direct or indirect financial relationship with faculty, as defined by Stark, then you're going to have to look to another exception to protect it. The other operational implication is that you're going to need some ability to document that the money that's been intended and actually used for these protected purposes was directed that way. So there's really embedded in the academic medical center exception a documentation component around the purpose of the payment that's different than other exceptions. And we'll talk in a few more minutes about some of the additional requirements for documentation and some of the operational and practical complexities that you face when you're talking about documentation compliance in an academic medical center that has multiple entities. I note here on slide 14, though, that clinical care is not on this specific list of purposes. And so I included on slide 15, preamble from the Phase 1 final rule, in particular to draw your attention to the last sentence of the quote,
from the preamble from CMS, where they say that we believe that patient care is integral to an academic medical center's community service mission. So that's a very helpful quote from the preamble, and we wanted to make sure you had the benefit of seeing that. And also in a minute you'll see when David walks us through the exception requirements for faculty, how faculty or clinical teaching is really core to the requirements of faculty in order to have physicians qualified for the exception. Moving to slide 16, another of the key academic medical center exception requirements is that the relationship among the components of the AMC has to be captured in written agreements or other written documents adopted by the governing body of each component. And it's interesting that they use the word relationship here. Many of the other exceptions actually focus on the word arrangement or agreement. But the key is that most academic medical centers have or need to have some kind of an overarching academic affiliation agreement or a mission support agreement adopted by the board that reflects their relationship. Now, in reality, most academic medical centers may also find themselves updating either specific line items or specific payment streams from time to time over the course of their relationship. They may do this annually. They may do this more frequently. And so one of the questions that gets raised is whether every line item, every specific payment stream needs to get board approval. But in most cases, you're going to have at least annual budgets that get approved by the boards of the respective components each year. And so the language in the exception about other written documents adopted by the board becomes helpful in terms of thinking about what constitutes the written evidence of the relationship among the AMCs. And so as a practical matter, you want to be thinking as you're evolving in your funds flow arrangements over time, how to tie those funds flows back to some written agreement or document that's been adopted by the board over time. And so with that, I want to turn it back to Jana.
Hi. So, Marcy, we get a lot of questions in this area because of the complexity, and wanted to talk through a couple of them with you and with others here. So, are community practitioners with teaching responsibilities eligible for the AMC exception?
David's going to talk in more detail in a few minutes about the requirements for the physicians within an academic medical center. But if by community practitioners you're talking about practitioners who are not employed by a component of the AMC, then those relationships, those financial relationships, are not going to qualify for the AMC exception. And so you'll have to look somewhere else to protect those financial relationships.
What about, a lot of people think that a medical school has to be part or one of the components in an AMC, in the AMC exception. Do you have to have a medical school involved?
Excellent question, Jana. If you go back to our slide number 12, where we identify the elements, the basic elements of an academic medical center, you'll see that you either need a medical school or the accredited academic hospital among the components, along with the faculty practice plan, and an affiliated hospital, which could be the same hospital or a different hospital. So, again, there's no mandate that you have any particular structure for an academic medical center other than that which we just talked about.
Okay. And I think at this point we're going to switch it because of timing. We'd love to talk about some other questions, and hopefully we can take your questions at the end, listeners. But we're going to switch it over to David Matthias to talk about AMC exception requirements for referring physicians.
Thanks, Jana. What Marcy had gone through were the various requirements associated with the components of the academic medical center exception and the legal structural issues. What we're now going to address is actually who the referring physicians are and the compensation going to those referring physicians. Slide number 18 is one that we kind of start off with, because as Marcy had explained, and on slide 14, talking about the transfers of money between the components of the teaching facility, of the AMC components, going for teaching services, indigent care, community service, and research, this slide specifically talks about research, and that all money that's being paid to a referring physician for research must actually be used for bona fide research, which is will be consistent with the terms of any kind of research grants that were obtained. And we provide you with a specific quote here associated with the use of research money for indigent care and community service. This is one of those areas where you show, see the overlap between the guidance coming from CMS and issuances coming from OIG as it relates to the hot topic area of research, research grants, and the use of research monies, the overlap into here, which again, to some extent, you'd say, why is CMS so worried about it? It comes from the concern about where research money is coming from. So they specifically have some language and reference there. But moving on to slide 19, we talk about who the referring physician must be in order to address their inclusion, as one of the questions Shana had said, into the AMC exception. Here we have three basic requirements. One, that the physician must be a bona fide employee of a component of an academic medical center, either on a full-time basis or substantial part-time basis. In addition, the physician doesn't have to be an employee of only one. There are, in terms of various models of AMCs out there, some physicians actually get checks from two components, the hospital and be it the School of Medicine or the university. So you can have one or both, but the point here is they have to be W-2 employees. Second requirement is that they be licensed to practice medicine in the state, and the third is that they have bona fide faculty appointments at the affiliated medical school or one or more of the educational programs at the accredited academic hospital. And the importance of that is, as italicized here, bona fide faculty appointments. It has to be following the typical process that the School of Medicine has, not that I, on a haphazard basis, want to say, oh, Marcy, you're a member of the faculty. It has to go through the regular process, even if you want to be a member of the faculty, Marcy. But let's move on to slide 20, which is some additional requirements, and that is that the referring physician must provide substantial, which I'll get to in a moment, academic services, clinical teaching services, or some combination of both. And what they've done in terms of defining substantial is not say you must meet these requirements, but they've created a safe harbor, which says if you meet these requirements, then definitely the physicians qualify as providing substantial, defined as at least 20% of their professional time is provided doing these things, or 8 hours per week. Again, it's a threshold to say if you meet it, then absolutely these physicians provide substantial services, but if you don't, it's going to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. Slide 21 provides you with a quote from the preamble associated with providing substantial academic and clinical teaching services, in particular, a discussion about primary care physicians and those primary care physicians who don't perform substantial academic or clinical teaching services. Sorry for that, that's construction next door, is that primary care physicians are, what they said is an important role here, but they don't fall within the physicians qualifying under the AMC exception. Instead, what CMS says is, we think you can probably find another exception, either through employment exception, personal services, or fair market value. When we move to slide 22, what we talk about is that the total compensation being paid by each AMC component to the referring physician must meet four standards. Set in advance, in the aggregate, it doesn't exceed fair market value, does not take into account the volume or value of referrals, and it does not violate the federal anti-kickback statute or any other law. Important word is total compensation paid by all the components in the aggregate. Because if you turn to slide 23, when we have some language from the preamble, which addresses that the total compensation that's paid within the AMC exception has to meet fair market value, but that each component of the payment itself doesn't necessarily have to be fair market value. So if the compensation is coming from two of the different components of the AMC, certain amount coming from the School of Medicine / University for teaching services, some from the hospital for providing some clinical services and the like, each of those components don't have to be separately evaluated for fair market value, but instead the notion is a common enterprise, that the whole AMC system as a whole is paying in the aggregate fair market value for the common services in totality that are being provided. Slide 24, in terms of fair market value, we get into the issue of, well, how do you determine fair market value for physicians in an academic setting? In particular, this slide talks about the relevant factors can include geography, the size of the academic institution, the scope of clinical and academic programs that are offered, the nature of the local healthcare marketplace. And here is some language that talks about the fact that productivity bonuses being paid to academic medical center physicians on the basis of personally performed services are also allowed. What slide 25 and the language from the phase two preamble talks about is that in determining fair market value for physicians in an AMC setting, you can either look at physicians in other academic medical center settings, or you can also look at basically physicians who are in private practice in order to lure them from private practice into the AMC setting. So these two slides together kind of give some additional flexibility as to what can be examined. Slide 26, again, some language from the preamble, talks about that these interpretations show that independent contractors or AMC physicians can be paid productivity bonuses based upon work that they personally perform. Independent contractor physicians within the faculty practice plan may not qualify for productivity under the AMC exception because they're independent contractors, but those faculty could get compensation, but also the members of the faculty practice plan within the AMC exception can also qualify. We see on slide 27 a few of the questions that we're being asked by clients, and I'll jump right into the first one, which addresses the documentation that a hospital should get from an AMC component that they're paying to faculty. The point here, the question comes up is, again, the faculty practice plan is completely separate from the hospital. The hospital is making payments over to another component. What does the hospital need to get in terms of assurances? We've talked internally here, and the advice we generally give is that there needs to be some level of accountability between the hospital and the faculty practice plan to attest to the fact that the physicians are being paid in a way that is consistent with the requirements of the AMC exception, with potentially the ability to, you know, get some information, be it on an aggregate basis or, you know, with certain examples and the ability to audit. But for compliance personnel, the notion here is if you're a compliance officer for the hospital, you don't necessarily need to have the right to go over to the faculty practice plan and audit every single payment that the faculty practice plan makes to the physicians to guarantee compliance here, because there can be some level of, you know, attestation and audit rights between the components. I think we've got time to go through one more of these, which is, can the amount of funds flow from the hospital to other AMC components be tied to the hospital's financial performance and still be protected under STARP? Well, the answer here in a very lawyerly way says, well, yes, but it depends. First of all, this question talks about can the funds flow from the AMC to the other component, the hospital to another component, vary based upon financial performance? And the answer to that is definitely yes, because a gain-sharing going to arrangement or similar type of arrangements going to the component of the AMC definitely is okay. The question still then is will those payments be allowed to the individual physicians? We still have to look at some of the other requirements associated with how that money is actually going down to the physicians and how whether or not we need another exception that CMS has been considering for gain sharing. So with that, Marcy, why don't you jump into slide 28 and talk about what's not protected by the exception?
Great. Thanks, David. So as you think about the various requirements of the exception that we just talked about, and you think about the components, how the physicians are paid, the purposes, requirements that are embedded in the AMC exception, you naturally start to think about, well, what falls outside of that? And our slide 28 is a short list of the kinds of arrangements that folks are going to have to think about qualifying under some other stark exception. So, for example, independent contractor physicians who are faculty not employed by a component of the AMC, not going to qualify under the AMC exception. Even employed physicians who don't provide the substantial academic and clinical teaching services that David talked about, for example, employed docs within the academic medical system that are primarily clinical only, again, may not, you know, won't qualify for protection. Their financial relationships won't qualify for protection under the AMC exception. Physicians who are employed by an entity that's not an AMC component potentially fall outside. Arrangements with unaffiliated hospitals, arrangements with hospitals that don't meet the majority test, payments or subsidies that are not used for one of the four protected purposes is another bullet that should be on the slide. Those are examples of financial arrangements that are going to require separate identification and analysis from a compliance perspective if at the end of the day they create direct or indirect financial relationships with referring physicians. Page 29 is a schematic that we would offer to hopefully folks will find helpful of an analysis under the AMC exception. So if you start in the top left box, are you an AMC or a component of an AMC, and you work through answering questions yes or no, you ought to come out on the right into one of the shaded boxes. That either the exception has been met if you work through that analysis, or that exception has not been met, and so you need to look elsewhere for protection. And if that's where you end up, and I'm moving to slide 30, then the question is, well, what are the other possible exceptions that apply? And our slide 30 gives a list of some of the other exceptions that you may need to be thinking about in connection with protecting the other or outside financial relationships with physicians. The first bullet is the one I want to talk about for just a minute, the indirect compensation arrangements exception, because other than the academic medical center exception itself, that's the one that academic medical systems tend to look to or consider in connection with their financial relationships with faculty as an alternative. The indirect analysis focuses at the end on whether physicians are ultimately getting compensated in any manner that fluctuates or varies with referrals or utilization at the hospital. And so if you find that there is an indirect compensation arrangement in your midst, then you either have to try to qualify for the exception, or in some cases you may decide that the definition hasn't been met and you actually have a financial relationship that arguably falls outside of STARK, although we tend to find folks with the belt and suspenders matter trying to meet the exception for even those categories of financial relationships. So you have this existence of two alternative potential regulatory approaches for academic medical centers, one AMC compliance and two indirect relationship compliance. And so the question is often asked, well, which is better, which is more desirable, which is easier to meet, which is easier to document, which is the better in proof if you're ever questioned about it. And Carrie, we're going to talk a bit more about that, answer to that question later. Carrie's going to talk later about some of the recent government enforcement actions that involve academic medical centers, and she will help shed some light on this issue over what's the relative benefits of the compliance strategies that you may have to choose from in the academic medical center context. So we'll get back to that. I want to turn to slide 31. This is an excerpt from the preamble, which I think gives some comfort to academic medical centers that if they have some financial relationships with referring physicians that fall outside the AMC exception, and the language here talks about to the extent that they can't take advantage of that exception, then they are legitimately allowed to look at another exception. So the fact that you have outside arrangements with physicians doesn't preclude your AMC qualification for the relationships that can meet those tests, and it's kind of a sigh of relief, I guess, for academic medical centers to know that they simply have to do a more line-by-line, relationship-by-relationship analysis for the arrangements that fall outside of the AMC protection. Slide 32 is another excerpt from CMS preamble from the regs, similar in theme, another quote from CMS giving comfort that academic medical centers can be STARK-qualified AMCs and still look to other exceptions as they need, specifically including indirect,
And again, Carrie will revisit some of the issues there in a few minutes. But I would say in thinking about the use of the indirect versus the AMC exception as a practical matter, and this is really true for all of Stark Law compliance, you really need, you're better served if you know up front what your regulatory compliance strategy is going to be, and you structure and document your relationships consistent with that thinking. You can find yourself at a disadvantage in, if it's ever questioned and if you are simply relying on some post hoc arguments in your defense as to what your compliance strategy was. You're entitled to take advantage of post hoc arguments if they're legitimate, but you're in a much better position from a litigation risk perspective if you have some clear thinking at the front end about where you are in the spectrum of compliance. And that's true for all of Stark, actually, whether it's documenting fair market value or whether it's documenting that you intended to be an AMC. Slide 33, just before we move off of the concept of the indirect compensation exception, slides 33 and 34 show you how technical the definition of an indirect compensation arrangement is and how technical the exception is. And actually, when you first read the definition and the exception, you can be confused in terms of telling the difference between what's the definition and what does the exception mean. But at the end of the day, the key overarching compliance issue is about how the doctor gets paid and whether or not the physician at the other end of the chain of relationships is paid in any way that fluctuates or varies with the referrals or utilization to the hospital. On slide 34, if you find that you need to, that you've triggered the indirect compensation relationship definition and you need to look at the exception, you're back into the same kind of compliance requirements that you have on the academic medical center side to the extent that the compensation received by the physician has to be fair market value and not determined in any manner that takes into account the volume or value of referrals. But in the indirect compensation scenario, it really turns out to be much more of an each relationship kind of analysis than the aggregate academic enterprise compliance analysis that we talked about earlier. Slide 35 is another excerpt from CMS on a slightly different exception, which here they're talking about physician recruitment, but it's meant to, again, give you some comfort that if you have physician relationships, including ones that are recruitment relationships, and you can't qualify them within the AMC exception, you can look elsewhere. This also actually says, this slide 35, that many recruitment relationships the government thinks will actually fall within the AMC exception. So it also reflects the breadth of protection that you can be afforded if you qualify as an AMC as defined by Stark. And with that, I'm going to turn it back to Jana.
Thanks, Marcy. I'm going to quickly go through the kickback slide. This is an important area. I don't mean to treat it lightly, but in the interest of time and the other materials, I have to go through it relatively quickly. So slide 37, when analyzing, just keep in mind when you're analyzing a physician-financial relationship under Stark that you do not forget about the anti-kickback statute, which prohibits the knowing and willful offer or payment or solicitation or receipt of anything of value in exchange for federal health care program referrals. So as stated on slide 38, the kickback statute applies to all items and services payable by the federal health care programs, not just designated health services and not just physician referrals. The kickback statute is criminal and intent-based, but various jurisdictions have held that intent can be proven if only one purpose of the arrangement was to induce referrals. If you meet an anti-kickback safe harbor, the arrangement is protected. If not, it doesn't mean a violation, but rather the arrangement needs to be analyzed on a facts and circumstances basis. In slides 39 to 41, we've provided some summaries of OIG opinions that discussed AMC arrangements, mostly about donations within the components of an AMC. And although, as you know, only the parties to the arrangement reviewed in the OIG opinion can rely on it, it provides some guidance on how the OIG views types of arrangements. And frankly, the OIG has viewed these arrangements favorably. So switching now to slide 42, you can see a nice side-by-side comparison of the Stark and anti-kickback laws, which lay out some of the differences. And it's important to note there is no safe harbor under the anti-kickback statute for AMCs. So ideally, your arrangement should meet one of the other safe harbors. Now I'm going to turn things over to Carrie to talk about recent government enforcement actions under the anti-kickback statute and START.
Thanks, Jana. We think that it's very important to spend some time talking about what happens when the government actually knocks on the door. I spend a lot of my practice time sitting across from prosecutors defending these kinds of matters and arrangements at the back end. And I've come to understand over the years that how these arrangements are viewed at the back end really informs to a large extent what you do at the front end to try to protect yourself. As everyone probably is aware, the most recent investigation in the news is the Northwestern Memorial matter. And everything that I'm talking about really is taken from public documents and published reports. In December, Northwestern Memorial acknowledged that they were subject to an OIG review regarding arrangements with the faculty practice plan. There were actually four subpoenas issued last August to the hospital, to the parent, to the fundraising arm, and to the faculty foundation. And the report is that it is regarding relationships between Northwestern Memorial and its faculty foundation. It came to light through a hospital bond filing, which to me is very interesting, because to a large extent we really try, when we're working with clients, to keep some of these matters under wraps so that they're not in the public eye, and it's not always that easy to do that given the financial exigencies and transactions that are going on. Northwestern Memorial, not surprisingly, is out there saying that the physician contracts are compliant and that they intend to fully cooperate. On slide 45, what we've learned from published reports is that possibly there's a whistleblower out there. There have been reports of doctors complaining about grants to medical staff and the faculty practice plan. It has not yet been verified as the actual cause of the investigation, but typically this is how these things happen, through complaints either by disgruntled physicians or competitors and the like. So anytime there are complaints, they need to be managed and thought about. Northwestern, of course, says that the grants are lawful, that they support the Academic Medical Center's mission and research and training, et cetera. It's very early on in this investigation. It's really hard to tell at this point what will happen. So by way of thinking about these things and what could possibly happen, let's take a look at two other cases in the Academic Medical Center setting that focused on Academic Medical Center relationships with physicians. And I think that these two cases that we'll talk about really describe the two ends of the spectrum, from those kinds of situations that at the end of the day the enforcers will find to be okay, and those that at the end of the day will be found to be problematic. First, we'll talk about the good ends of the spectrum, which is the Villafani case. Villafani is the name of the whistleblower, and there are actually two reported federal cases on this matter, and we call them Villafani 1 and Villafani 2. And both of them talk about the stark AMC exception and kickback implications of these kinds of physician financial relationships in an academic medical center setting, and together they produce what I consider to be very good case law, and we should all sort of hang this stuff on our walls because it's good stuff. The Villafani case started as a whistleblower action by a disgruntled physician. So the government investigated and declined to pursue it. And for those of you who don't know how these kinds of whistleblower QI-TAM actions work, when the QI-TAM case is filed, the government has a statutory obligation to investigate it and decide whether to take the case on. If the government decides to decline the case, the whistleblower can pursue it on their own. And most of those end up being losers, but they do it because they're disgruntled, and that's what happened here. The case is a funds flow case, and you know, as most academic medical center funds flow arrangements are complicated, this one was complicated, but to kind of boil it down, the hospital and the physician practices contributed to a research fund. The research fund redistributed the funds to pay faculty's salaries, and not surprisingly, the whistleblower didn't get any of the funds, so he was not too happy about it. Moving on to slide 47, so why did I say that this is a great case? Well, the best thing about Villafani 1 is its pronouncement on the Stark kickback interception. If you, according to this case, if you meet the Stark AMC exception, there is no anti-kickback violation. And on slide 47, I have the quote from the case. Frame it. It's a wonderful statement of what we have hoped the law would be for years and years. It validates our longstanding thinking about the advantages of meeting an exception such as the AMC exception, which is so very specific about what you have to meet, that it really ought to provide more broad-based protection. And in fact, the court found that it did. And I'm going to read it. Although as a matter of law, the AMC exception does not apply to the anti-kickback statute, as a practical matter, satisfaction of the former will indicate there has been no violation of the latter. Payments made between the components of an AMC necessarily support the missions of teaching, indigent care, research, or community service, and may not exceed the fair market value of the academic and clinical teaching services provided. As such, they are not made to induce referrals and thus cannot be characterized as kickbacks that would violate the anti-kickback statute. Okay, frame that one. Okay, so that's the good news about Villafani 1. The bad news is that although at the end of the day we got a good result, it took a while to get there. And it took a while to get the court to actually make a determination with respect to compliance with the academic medical center exception in the Stark law. The sort of good news was that the case didn't have to go to trial. The judge offered an early hearing opportunity to prove that the academic medical exception was met, and thus we have the Villafani 2 case. So I'm on page 49, and in that case, Villafani 2, we got an excellent interpretation of the AMC exception. What the court said was that the AMC exception is flexible, it's purpose-oriented, and it's not hyper-technical. So, for example, although the court found that some of the time records that were kept by the physicians here left something to be desired, as we all know when we look at physician time records, that's usually the case, what the court really looked at was whether the physicians were truly engaged in academic medical practice. The court also looked at the academic responsibilities of these full-time faculty members and said that they were enormous, that they were supervising hundreds of medical students and residents, it was obvious that they did rounds, that their annual work assignments reflected all of their academic responsibilities, their performance reviews, and their CVs did as well. On slide 51, the court looked at the sense of fair market value and compensation and basically said it's fine if it's in line with national salary data. And they said specifically that if you're at the high end of the range over the 75th percentile, they are fine with that in an academic setting because the physicians are highly qualified and at or near the top of their profession, which I think is a very important statement because a lot of AMCs typically attract the best and the brightest, and in order to do so need to pay at the high end, and you know, have always voiced some concerns about, you know, the proving that the compensation is fair market value on that basis. So that was welcome guidance. And the court ultimately said that if compensation, compensation is not based on the volume or value of referrals, if it's set at fair market value and doesn't vary once set, so you don't have to worry about that either. Moving to the writing requirement, the court said that on slide 52, the court said they're satisfied as long as there's an established course of conduct that's appropriately documented. So let's compare that to the UMDNJ case, which is, to me, at the other end of the spectrum. And by the way, all of this as well is from public documents. In 2002, UMDNJ faced a possible state-ordered shutdown of its cardiac surgery program because it was performing less than the required number of surgeries to keep that status. And that could have threatened its certification as a level one trauma center. Beginning in 2003, there were agreements that were struck with community cardiologists to be hired as part-time employed faculty. And on slide 54, at the time, UMDNJ was already under a deferred prosecution agreement for double billing by the hospital and the faculty practice plan. And that required an appointment of an outside monitor to oversee operations. And the community cardiologist relationships came to light through this monitor. I've included here a quote from the monitor's report because the monitor found that the payments to the community cardiologist were disguised as salaries, were not paid for medical services, they were nothing more than referral fees, paid to doctors in order to induce them to bring their patients to UMDNJ. These payments were and are illegal under federal law. Now, that's the monitor's conclusion, which to me is interesting as to what happens when you have sort of an outside monitor come in and oversee your operations. These were legal conclusions that ended up being reported to the government. So what were these payments that the monitor was reporting, and what might have been the problem here? Well, they were employment contracts. They were $50,000 to $180,000 per physician. They call for part-time work as clinical assistant professors. They call for teaching at the medical school, on-call coverage, weekly conferences, lecturing, and supporting UMDNJ research efforts. According to the monitor report, it was $5.7 million that was paid to 18 physicians since 2002. And they actually detailed the math in the monitor report as to the potential fines and penalties. So what's the problem here? It looks like there was paperwork in place. But interestingly enough, all of these 18 physician relationships all looked essentially the same. They all had essentially the same contract. It was also determined that a number of these physicians made nearly as much as the full-time professors. Many of them had no research or teaching experience. Many of them admitted to not teaching a single lecture while being paid for that sort of activity. A lot of them had never used the hospital before the agreement, and then all of a sudden they started referring hundreds of patients to the hospital. And interestingly to me, one of the things that was talked about was that when they looked at the internal documents, and this goes back to Marcy's point, there was really no discussion in the documents or in communications among the parties of why these 18 physicians were needed for clinical purposes, why they were needed for services to the underserved or for educational purposes. So there was no sort of thinking at the front end as to the need for these folks, what they would be doing, and making sure that the services, not only on paper, but also in practice, would be bona fide. So it's clear that the enforcers are going to look beyond the paperwork at operational facts. This doesn't necessarily mean that you can't have relationships with community physicians that could be made to qualify under the AMC exception, but you're going to really have to look at facts and circumstances. It's going to be important. You're going to need to look to establish a bona fide employment relationship. What's interesting about the end result here is that a number of the physicians themselves have settled allegations with the U.S. Attorney's Office. They have entered criminal pleas for embezzlement. They paid fines equivalent to multiples of their salaries and amounts referred to the hospital. And so for those who think, I know a lot of hospitals think that only they're the ones that are looked at and only they are liable and the doctors never get theirs, this one's for you. These doctors have actually had to settle these things. So let me turn this over to Beth at this point to talk about transparency and disclosure and some of the obligations that are going to be coming along.
Thank you. That was great. I'm going to talk a little bit differently, a little bit different information about a couple of things that are happening which will cause hospitals to make disclosures to the government. This is the new age of transparency. I think we're going to have more demands for disclosure. Information is going to be available electronically. There's going to be the ability of the government to engage in data mining and finding more information. And I'm just going to talk about two of these things, the new IRS Form 990 and the proposed DFRR. The Form 990 is the form that tax-exempt institutions such as tax-exempt hospitals file annually. And the new form was in place for 2008, the core form, and there we saw enhanced disclosure of compensation of key employees, executives, and others. And I think in that way we saw increased disclosure of information regarding physician compensation. I want to point out that the Form 990 is publicly available to everybody. That if you go on the website www.guidestar.com and register, you can see a PDF of essentially every charity's filed 990. You can look at your competitors and other hospitals' compensation for the years that they filed those forms. Now, in 2009, for tax year 2009, which is where we are now, there is the additional requirement for hospitals to complete Schedule H. And I'm sure many of you have been thinking about Schedule H, particularly in connection with the community benefit-related issues. But there is a nice little piece of Schedule H that relates to hospital-physician relationships. And just to demonstrate it to you, if you look at slide 61, that's an actual photocopy off of the form on Schedule H, and it's a demonstration and disclosure of hospital-physician joint venture and management agreements. And remember, this is going to be a publicly filed form. So if hospitals contemplate their physician relationship, it's very important to think about the fact that the government, the hospital's competitors, the other doctors on their medical staff are going to be able to see on the website information that's contained in this Schedule H. And that's that form. Now, the DFRR, which is the Disclosure of Financial Relationships Report, is a completely different report, and it comes out of CMS, and it is currently being considered by the Office of Management and Budget. Comments were due by January 20th. They were delayed a few days because of the inauguration, and EBG has an alert about this form, and as well as some comments that we filed on behalf of some of our clients, which are available on our website. And this form is really remarkable. It's going to be sent to 400 hospitals, is the proposal. However, in the description of the proposal, CMS made clear that they do intend and they are considering surveying all hospitals either annually or on a staggered session. While the future of this particular form is not clear, it is still before OMB, and while this is only projected to go to 400 hospitals, I think we can take from this the fact that we can expect and we should expect to hear from CMS and some kind of disclosure of hospital-physician relationships. It's definitely in our future. And this form queries hospitals about their relationships with their physicians. And before I describe some of those questions, I want to read you something else from the CMS description of what they intend to do. They say that each hospital will be analyzed separately to determine whether the financial relationships are in compliance with STARC. I pulled that directly from the material. That means hospitals are going to be disclosing their relationships with physicians, and CMS will be getting the materials, and they will be analyzing them. And you already heard today about the draconian, horrible consequences should a hospital violate STAR. Now CMS is going to require that we disclose those relationships to CMS, and they will have to be able to analyze them. So here's what you're going to have to disclose. And I didn't put a copy of that form in your material. It's available on the website, on the CMS website, but it includes descriptions of ownership. It includes the descriptions of ownership information, interests, compensation relationships, personal service arrangements, many of the hospital-physician relationships. Plus, the hospital is directed to indicate which stark exception those arrangements fall under. And we all know that many of those relationships predate stark in its current iteration, the current regulations, and that maybe they weren't entered into prospectively contemplating the particular stark exception. So they're going to need to be analyzed and placed in the stark exception. And not only those that comply with the stark exceptions, but the instructions to the form specifically require hospitals to indicate those arrangements that are, quote, implicated by the referred exception. So if you goofed and missed an exception, if you came close but didn't really make it into the exception, this form actually requires, as it's written, that the hospital disclose that relationship, describe it, give the physician name, give the physician's NPI so that the physician can be identified. And if you look at the last slide, which is my favorite, the hospital, this is a quote, must include a copy of all those agreements with their submitted DFRR, and we expect that we'll hear soon whether that form is going to be in place for 2009. And that, right on schedule.
Yes, thank you, Beth. Amber, can you walk through for the participants what the instructions are in order to be able to ask some questions?
Absolutely. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically today. To ask a question, simply press your star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. Again, that's star 1 on your phones. Please keep in mind if your mute button is turned on to please turn that off so your signal does reach us. And again, it is star 1.
While we're waiting for some people hopefully to be queuing up to ask some questions, let me ask Marcy. So a common question in the AMC setting is, so what happened to Stand in the Shoes?
That's a good question, and it gave academic medical centers in particular, I think, a lot of concern when CMS first issued the regulatory concept that physicians were going to stand in the shoes of their physician organization. And naturally the question was, well, wait a minute, that can't possibly be true for faculty physicians. They're going to stand in the shoes of the faculty practice plan, and therefore all of the funds flow that we talked about earlier under those various models. And in the magnitude that tends to flow within these academic medical centers is going to be attributed to those faculty. At the end of the day, it's not going to be applied that way. Academic medical center physicians that are only employed within the system don't stand in the shoes of their faculty practice plan. So that's good news. And it's another example of not just AMCs, but others that have the opportunity to work with CMS to kind of meet the balance between what really goes on in the industry and what ought to be accomplished from the CMS, legitimate public policy and enforcement perspective.
Carrie, let me throw one question over to you, which is one thing that we're waiting for in terms of enforce or effectiveness is October 09, the whole notion of per-click arrangements, under-arrangements, all of the limitations that become effective October. Do we have to worry about those in the AMC setting?
Well, I think just like all other academic medical center relationships, you have to think about whether you have to think about those things. But again, the AMC exception is an extremely broad exception. It applies to all services. And so if you have relationships between the components of an AMC, there may well be some of those arrangements that otherwise are going to require some restructuring that may well fit within the AMC exception.
Terrific. Amber, do we have anyone queued up?
We do. We have two questions queued up. As a reminder, it is star 1 for questions. I also apologize if I mispronounce any names. We'll first hear from Omid Talal.
Good morning. Referring back to your slide 20, there's a bullet point there that says a physician is deemed to meet the substantial requirement if he or she spends at least 20% professional time or 8 hours per week. That implies that there has been established a 40-hour work week as standard, and certainly on our experience, usually the contention is that academic physicians work much more than a 40-hour work week. Has there, in fact, been that standard established?
No, there hasn't necessarily been that standard established, which is also where I think CMS and why they created the wiggle room in saying that this is just a safe harbor. You can deal with it on a case-by-case basis, and therefore it doesn't necessarily have to be. If it's greater than a 40-hour work week, then it works to the physician's advantage to go with an 8 hours per week as opposed to 20% of their professional time. But again, there has not been any recognition as to how many hours a week physicians or academic physicians perform.
Thank you.
And again, that's star one for questions. We'll now hear from Rhonda Lees, American Diabetes Associates.
Oh, hi. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Okay. What do you see as the implications for nonprofit associations regarding this, whether the money is also coming in for research as well as other purely educational events?
Where's the money? I'm sorry to ask back a question to you. Where's the money coming from?
Let's say from the pharma industry.
Okay, well, Jenna, and I'll throw it kind of to you because you've been staying on top of the vendor relationship issues. That really falls outside of, you know, some of the issues here of satisfying Stark and the academic medical center exception.
Yes.
Because this is really talking about the funds flow among the components, the issue of money coming into the academic medical center from various vendors, pharma, and the like. There's been, you know, a tremendous amount of...
There's been a lot of discussion on the issue. I mean, I think both pharma and the device companies have been really watching the Stark rules very closely. But even in the latest iterations by CMS, it's not Stark. If the money is coming from pharma or device, at this point, Stark does not apply. So you really need to be analyzing those relationships under the anti-kickback statute. Hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah, and a lot of the issues come up, and I think it is being addressed in the Patient Sunshine Act, which is dealing with, you know, more transparency of financial relationships but among components of the industry and physicians, which is what led some major institutions, I'm just throwing out Cleveland Clinic right now, who's been in the newspapers recently talking about how they're making everything available on their website and limiting the amount of perks that come to the physicians.
Yeah, we've actually, the AHLA has done a white paper on healthcare professional vendor relationships. I mean, it's a huge topic, so,
Amber, do we have any other questions in queue?
We do have more questions, just one further one. Again, that will be star one for questions, and we'll now hear from Edmund Lagama, Maria Ferrari Children's Hospital. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
I'm looking at slide 22 and the comment about in the aggregate may not exceed fair market value for the services provided. How precise is the estimate of fair market value, and how much do you need to exceed it to be in excess of the regulation?
Fair market value is, and one thing that we as lawyers don't necessarily have the ability to opine on and the like, but the guidance that I provide both to clients and we all with working with consultants is fair market value compensation to physicians is not an exact number. It is a range. And therefore, going out and getting, you know, comparable issues, you find out what the range is. To the extent that you exceed that range, well, you're beyond fair market value. But if you're within what the range is for the particular type of physician in the specialty in the geographic region, looking at some of the different, you know, factors that are set forth in 25 and slides 24 and 25 in terms of geography, the size of the academic institution, the type of specialty. As long as you're within a range of fair market value as, you know, determined by outside factors using consultants, then you're okay. But once you go beyond what the upper end is, then you're, it's problematic.
Right. I think the importance is with respect to documentation. And what you don't want from a government enforcement standpoint is to find out 7 years or, you know, 8 years after you entered into a relationship that everyone at that time knew was fair market value, not to have in that particular file what you relied upon, because people change and you can't always put your hands on whatever the materials are that were used at that time. So whatever it is that you are relying on to demonstrate fair market value, whether it's a report from a consultant or just some of the publicly available surveys that are out there, you know, it is good practice, it is best practice these days to make sure that you have your file rounded out at the front end and not at the back end.
One of the comments that you had addressed, Marcy, had to do with the fact that there's a written agreement. Can one CEO of the AMC just sign an agreement? What process needs to be had in order to satisfy the writing?
That's a good question, David. And we get asked that in connection with fund flow, you know, special kinds of fund flow projects that arise during the middle of the year. So you may have an academic affiliation agreement or a mission support agreement that's, you know, years and years old, dates back to the 1980s, something like that, and still fairly covers the relationships, the overarching relationships between the parties, but doesn't necessarily cover in every detail all of the line item programmatic elements that the parties want to accomplish together consistent with their academic, joint academic mission. And so you have this question about, you know, the regulation is pretty clear that the document doesn't need to be one agreement. It could be more than one written document, but it does need to be adopted by the governing body. And so, you know, best practices is really to make sure that these kind of special projects or individual projects, as they come up, that they get tied back in some way to a written material that's been approved by the governing body. So that would mean either tied back to the academic affiliation or mission support agreement or to budgets that have been approved by the governing body. And if there's any degree of question or discomfort or debate about whether that's the case, to, you know, the conservative best practice approach would be to tie it back, take it to the board, reflect it in board minutes, you know, at some appropriate juncture in terms of board proceedings, make sure that there's statement, you know, introduced into the board proceedings that ties that back together. But it's not. I think that when it reflects an important element of the policy behind this from CMS's perspective, which is they really want the governing entities of these mission-driven organizations to know and determine where funds are being spent. So you could get you could have a problem if you run too far off the field.
I just want to add, it's the governing body of each component, and that's right out of the regs. And sometimes there's an overarching sort of academic medical center governing body. That's not good enough. So the faculty practice plan, if it's a captive PC, it has a governing body. It has to approve this agreement for the exception to be effective.
Amber, are there any other questions in queue?
There are no further questions.
Well, if there are no further questions, let me end by, first of all, informing everyone wanting CLE credit that the CLE number and code for this session is AMC0209. Again, that's AMC0209. And Epstein, Becker & Green's Healthcare and Life Sciences Practice Group would like to thank everyone for participating in this program. We referenced in a number of places some certain materials that are on EBG's website. You can also get information on contacting any of us, not only about some of the issues addressed herein, but if there are any recommendations for additional teleconferences that we can provide to you all in the community, we'd be more than happy to. So with that, I'd like to thank everyone, and let us know if we can be of further assistance.
And that concludes today's conference. We do appreciate your participation. Everyone, have a great day.